And questions are asked for various reasons. Sometimes questions are asked for information. You ask a question because you want to know the information. I don't know the answer. I want to know what the answer is to that. Sometimes biblical questions are asked from that vantage point. I want to know what the answer is. I want to know what the answer. Some questions are raised to emphasize a point. You're not looking for the answer. You're trying to make a point with the question. And so it's a rhetorical question, perhaps. Some questions are asked to provoke a thought. You just want somebody to think about something, ponder something. Questions have been asked all through the Bible by God and by man. Sometimes God asked man a question. Sometimes a man would ask God a question. Habakkuk, we'll get into that in our next study. In our Bible classes on Sunday morning, Habakkuk asked God a question. How long are you going to let this go on? Why are you doing this? So man asked God questions. Man asked other men questions. Not all questions are worth asking. Perhaps you've been asked questions that you think, well, that's a silly question. That's not even worth phrasing the words of that because they're not worth asking. But there are questions found in the Bible that are worth asking. So I want to talk a little while about questions worth asking. Let's find some questions in the Bible. Or at least we're going to find some basis for questions to be asked. And we'll look at this in three parts. And here's the first thing I want us to consider. First of all, let's talk about questions that have been asked by God. They must be good questions. They must be worth asking because God Himself raised these questions. And so let's just open our Bibles and look at the context of these passages. And we'll raise the question and make some application there too. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 20, if you will. Here's a question that was asked by God. The parallel account will be found in Isaiah 39. We'll not look at Isaiah because the same question is found there. But 2 Kings 20, if you will. This is where Hezekiah's life in the beginning of the chapter had been extended for some years. And we notice that in verse 12 beginning, there was an envoy from Babylon that came to see Hezekiah. They were not coming merely to congratulate him and wish him good health. They have something more in mind, and that is there's an effort to form an alliance against Assyria. As we talked this morning in Bible class, the Assyrian threat is still at power. And so they're trying to form an alliance. They're looking for more. But Hezekiah doesn't see all of that. And so Hezekiah, as he welcomes them, beginning at verse 13, he was attentive to them and he showed them all the treasures of his house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious ornament and all of his armory and all that was found in his treasure. There was nothing in his house and in his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. He's showing it all off. And Isaiah the prophet, yeah, that's the same Isaiah of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah the prophet came to King Hezekiah and he said, what did these men say when they came to you? And Hezekiah said, well, they were from a far country, from Babylon. Now, verse 15, here is our question. And he said, this is Isaiah said this to Hezekiah, what have they seen in your house? What did you show them? What did they see? And he said, at verse 15, they have seen all that is in my house, and there is nothing in my treasures that I do not show them. And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, he said, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming, verse 17, when all that is in your house and in your father's have accumulated unto this day shall be carried to Babylon and nothing shall be left. You're going to lose it all to this Babylon envoy is what you're going to do. But his question was a good question, repeated in Isaiah 39 and in verse 4. What have they seen in your house? And his answer was, they've seen all that is in my house. What have they seen in your house? That's a good question, isn't it? That's worth asking. What have they seen in your house? What have your neighbors seen in your house? What have your children seen in your house? What have your fellow Christians seen in your house? That's a question worth asking. Do they see people who really love and care about each other? Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5 talks about how husbands love their wives. And they love their wives even as themselves, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. That is, here's a husband that loves his wife so much, he's willing to sacrifice his own life on her behalf. Do they see that in your house? Verse 33, you wives, see that you reverence or respect your husband. Do they see that in your house? Do your neighbors see that? Do your children see that? Do they see that mom really reverences and respects dad? We know it without a doubt. She didn't have to tell us, we see it. And we see dad really loves mom. Do they see that? What have they seen in your house? Do they see the family comes first? Where the father's here in Ephesians chapter 6, while you're in the book of Ephesians, you were at Ephesians chapter 5, go to chapter 6 now, just one chapter over, and you see children are to be obedient to the parents, honor your father and your mother. Do you see where family comes first, where children are being taught the principles of honoring and respecting the parents? Where fathers are committed to this at verse 3 or verse 4, not provoking their children to wrath, but rather bringing them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. Children come first, and family comes first on the part of the father and the mother. Do they see that in your family? What have they seen in your house? Do they see this? Do they see who's really in lead and in charge? Ephesians 5:23, still in this text. Verse 23 said, the husband is the head of the wife. It's not a boss. Not the idea of one who is in command. It is the idea of responsibility and leadership. When the children begin to see what's in your house, and your neighbors see what's in your house, and your brethren and friends see what's in your house, have they seen all that's in your house, and do they see who's really leading? I want to tell you, there are some homes where mama's in charge, and she wears the pants in the family, and she calls the shots. And dad is the one who says, yes, ma'am, to whatever she says. And children take note of that. What have they seen in your house? Have they seen a successful communication going on between mom and dad and parent and children? And I cite this passage in Matthew 19 in verse 6, where the husband and wife are to be one flesh. That is more than the intimate relationship. This is a blending of lives in every aspect. They're one in aim and one in goal and one in purpose. You can't do that without communication. Do they see that in your house? Do they see a mom and dad that communicate effectively? And do your brethren see that? And do your friends see effective communication? Do they see discipline and restraint? Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, the proverb writer would say, but the rod will drive it far from him. And when you allow people to see into your house, as Hezekiah did, and they see all that is in the house, and they see how you handle your children, do they see the principle of discipline and restraint, where you're restraining your children and you discipline the children and you correct the problem, or do they see toleration of what goes on in your household? What have they seen in your house? That's worth asking, isn't it? Do they see a keeper at home? Do they come in and see someone that's not a keeper at home when things are constantly a mess, or do they see one who is a keeper at home? And so, you know what? She's doing her responsibility, and she has her responsibility before God understood, and she is a keeper at home. What have they seen in your house? That's worth asking. Let's go to the book of Jeremiah. God asked another question. Jeremiah the prophet prophesied about the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of Judah and the rise of Babylon. That's an important point in this context of Jeremiah 27. And one of the things that Jeremiah preached was that when Babylon rises up and they take you into captivity, don't resist, don't fight, don't rebel, willingly yield to Babylon because they're going to take you. That's what I promised you and that's what I told you is going to happen. And resisting is only going to be for your own harm. So beginning at verse 12, I spoke to Zedekiah, the king of Judah, according to these words, bring your necks under the yoke of Babylon and serve him and his people and live. This is the key to living. When Babylon comes and Nebuchadnezzar comes into your region, you willingly yield to the king and you yield to his servants and you become his servant and you're going to live. Everything's going to be okay. Now, verse 13, why will you die and your people by the sword, by the famine and by the pestilence, as the Lord has spoken against the nation that will not serve the king of Babylon? Notice what his question is. Why will you die when I've given you the key and the principle upon which you can live? Babylon is the threat. Babylon is coming. Nebuchadnezzar is marching through. And when he gets here, I'm giving you the key of how you can live. And your life will be spared. So I want to know. I want to ask you something, he said to Zedekiah. I want to know, why will you die when I've told you how to live? That's a good question. That's worth asking, isn't it? From a spiritual standpoint, why would you die spiritually, lose your soul, when you've been given a way of life? Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And why would you, in a condition of being lost, continue in that and then ultimately just die when God has given you the way of life? Wouldn't it be foolish to go back in the day of Zedekiah and say, you know what, God said if we yield, we're going to live. But I tell you what I'm going to do, I'm going to fight to the end. Why would you want to die? Why would you die when you have an opportunity now? Today is the day of salvation. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 2. The emphasis of the passage is not so much today versus waiting till tomorrow, but we're living in the time of salvation. This is the day that the prophets talked about. This is the day of the coming of the kingdom. This is the day of the Messiah, when we can be saved through the Messiah. Why would you die when the day has come wherein we could be saved? And why would you die when God begs you to live? All day long I've stretched forth my hands unto a disobedient and gainsaying people. When God is standing with his arms outstretched, begging you to come and have life, why would you die? There are people who need to obey the gospel. They will not answer that invitation. There are people who need to make correction who will not answer that invitation. Here's a question worth asking. Why will you die when I've told you how to live? Here's another question. Let's go to the New Testament this time. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5, if you will, in the Sermon on the Mount. And here's a good question. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said in beginning at verse 43, let's get the context, and then we'll come to verse 47. He said, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. This is what's been taught by some of the rabbis. And that you ought to love your neighbor and you hate your enemy. And Jesus said, no, that's not the way it is. He said, I say, do you love your enemies and bless those who curse you and do good to those who hate you and pray for those who despitefully use you? Now notice at verse 46, for if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors, that is the publicans, do the same? Now verse 47, and if you greet your brethren only, what do you more than others? That's a question worth asking. What do you more than others? Jesus is teaching a principle that my law goes further and beyond the principle of the rabbis. And their interpretation of the Old Testament law. They said, love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. And he said, no. I go further than that. Love your neighbor and love your enemy. Do good to your neighbor, do good to your enemy. And if you only do good to your neighbor and to your friend and to your brethren, then how are you any better than anybody else? That's his question. How are you any better than the hypocrite that he mentioned in verse 46? You're no better than the publicans, he said. The hypocrites. You're no better than the Pharisees. How are you any better than the half-hearted? Are you? There are always members that are kind of half-hearted. They don't really hit it hard. They kind of hit it halfway. And now my question to you is, how are you any better than them? If you're half-hearted, you're no better. What do you more than others? Are you better than others? That's not an arrogant statement or a question about arrogance, but do you strive to be better than what others are doing? What do you more than others? How are you better than those who do pretty much whatever they want? Do you know anybody, any Christian that just pretty much does what they want to do, live like they want to live, live by their own standard? How are you any better than that? What do you more than others? Good question, isn't it? And how are you better at showing you're trying to live above the world? Are you trying to show that you're living above the world, that you don't have the world standards? Are you trying to get so close to the edge of the standard of the world and the standard of God that you look like you're living like the world, or maybe you've gone across the line and you're living like the world? How are you any better than others? Good question. What do you more than others? What are you doing more than anyone else? Than the rest of the world or the hypocrite? Here's another question. Let's turn to John 6 and verse 67. John 6. Jesus had made some statements in the context about being the bread of life. And one must eat and partake of that. in order to have fellowship with God. And I want you to notice in John 6 and in verse 60 that the disciples said, this is a hard saying, who can understand it? He's not saying this is difficult for us to comprehend. You're going to have to go over it again. We don't get it. That's not the point. The point is, this is hard to accept. This is hard to swallow. Now remember that times the disciples encompassed not just the 12, the immediate apostles, but it encompassed a vast multitude that was following after Jesus, and at this point there had been many. And Jesus goes on to say, as the disciples were murmuring about what was said, verse 61, at verse 66, he said, the words that I speak to you, they are spirit and life. That is, the things that I'm having to say to you are spiritual in their application. That's how you can understand it, and that's how you can apply it. I'm talking about spiritual things. Now then, that didn't go over too well with some. Verse 66, and from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. Many of that multitude turned, and they're not interested in that anymore. They'd been following him for the loaves and the fishes, but they're not interested in following him for the spiritual meat. And they're not interested now when he says, my words, they are spirit and they are life. And they turn and walk away. Now, verse 67, Jesus turned to the 12 and said, do you also want to go away? That's a question worth asking, isn't it? Are you going to do the same thing? Now, get a picture of a multitude here, and most of the crowd leaves, and they're not interested in Jesus anymore. And Jesus turns to his immediate 12, and he said, do you want to go away too? You want to go with them? You're going to turn your back on me as well? That's a question worth asking. There are some that leave because they're not interested in the spiritual. That was the case here in this context. Do you also want to go away because you're not interested in the spiritual? You see, that's a harsh question. Jesus asked it of the apostles, didn't he? It was designed to challenge their thinking, to challenge their allegiance. Are you just like they are? Or are you going to stick with me through thick and through thin? There are some who leave because they're discouraged. They throw up their hands and quit. They get discouraged and they quit. I can't take it anymore. Do you also want to go away? It's a challenge of your faithfulness. Some leave because they want their sin. And they don't want to give it up. Well, that happened to you. You say, I choose the sin over the Lord, and I'm going to go away too. That's a question worth asking, isn't it? Here's another question worth asking. Turn to Luke 6, 46. Perhaps this is one of our more familiar questions. In Luke 6 and verse 46. And Jesus said, this is in Luke's account of the Sermon on the Mount, and the question was, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? The theme of the sermon is about the kingdom of God, as per Matthew 4, which is an introduction to chapter 5, which is the starting of the Sermon on the Mount. And dealing with the kingdom of God, this is the way it's going to be in my kingdom. There's not going to be this pledge of allegiance, but then you don't really follow through with that pledge. So his question was, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? The word Lord means ruler. So the question is, why do you call me ruler if you're not going to allow me to rule your life? Does he rule your family life? You stop and think about that. Does he rule your family life? In other words, you look to the ruler and say, the ruler said, this is what a husband's to be. This is what the ruler said the wife is to be. This is what the ruler said the parents are to be. And this is what the ruler said the children are to do. And we're going to follow the ruler. Whether that's what we want to do or not, we're going to follow the ruler. Does he rule in your family? Is this the first source you go to when there are family problems? Does he rule in your thoughts? Do you have thoughts about people? Do you have thoughts about things that are in harmony with the scriptures, or do you try to harmonize those with the scriptures? Does he rule your thoughts? Do you have hatred in your heart? Do you have envy in your heart? Does he rule your thoughts? That I try to govern and bring even my thoughts into captivity to Christ, as Paul talked about in 2 Corinthians 10. Does he rule in your personal godliness? Does he rule your personal life? Your personal godliness. Does he control that? Does he rule your business life? Do you make business decisions? You say, I can't do that because my ruler said I can't do that. That would be dishonor. I can't do that. And that's shady. I can't do that because my ruler said. Does he rule in your school life? I'm not going to participate in this in school because my ruler said otherwise. Does he rule in your daily life? Why do you call me your ruler when you don't let me rule in your life? That's his question. That's worth asking. Let's go back to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's account of this in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus talks about worry and anxiety. And he talks about the futility of that doesn't really do any good. In fact, in the context, as we'll see in a moment, it is a form of materialism. Worrying about your food and your clothing and your shelter. What are we going to do? What are we going to do tomorrow? How are we going to make it? I don't understand how we're going to make it. What are we going to do? And you're tore up and you're filled with fretfulness and anxiety and you're worried about material things. It's a form of materialism as per the context of Matthew chapter 6. So at verse 27, Jesus said, "Which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature?" That's a question worth asking. There's a question about translation here. Does the cubic and the stature, does that have reference to, by worrying, can man add to his height? Some think that it has reference to adding a cubic. That'd be quite a distance to add to his stature at a minimum of 18 inches. It's probably not talking about, but it's talking about a milepost as your lifespan. You worried about your life. Who by worrying, as one translation would say, can add a even 18 inches to the measure of life. The American Standard so translates it. In other words, which one of you can add to his milepost? In other words, if you think your milepost is and you're going to die at a certain age, by worrying about it and worrying about your health, do you think you can add even 18 inches to that milepost and just you'd live just a little bit longer? The point of the question is it doesn't do any good. It doesn't do any good. And so when we talk about worry, anxiety, we're talking about being troubled with cares, Thayer says, is what that means. And so when you're burdened down with cares, that's a form of materialism. The question Jesus is asking is, what good did that do for you? And so when you've just been knotted up one day and you're worried about something in your life and you've just fretted about it all day, at the end of the day, what did you accomplish? Are things better because you worried? Things may be better because you prayed. Things may be better because you thought of an answer or you thought of something you ought to be doing. But your worrying didn't make it any better. That's the point Jesus is making. Which of you by worrying can add one cubic to his stature? So why worry about it? It's not going to do any good. That's a question worth asking. Here's another, Mark 8, verse 36. One more on that, and then we're going to shift gears and talk about a different category of questions. Let's turn to Mark 8 and verse 36. This is talking about discipleship in the context, and Jesus raised this question, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and lose his own soul? That's a question worth asking, isn't it? What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and lose his own soul? You see, your soul is everything. In fact, it's all you have. If you want to talk about things that you have that are yours, what would you name? You say, well, I've got land. No, that's not yours. You're going to leave that behind. It's only here for your use. I've got material possessions. That's not yours. It's just for your use. Well, at least I've got my body. No, that's just yours for your use. You gained a body when you came in this world, and you're going to leave it when you go out. Only thing you've got left is your soul. That's all you have. That's the only thing you have. That's all you've got. That's yours. That you're going to keep forever. And so the question is, what would it profit you if you gained something that seems to be of great importance, like the whole world, but then you lost your soul, the only thing you have? What if you gain an education, and in the process, you lose your soul? So how could you do that? Could we not be corrupted by the liberalism of the day? Those who are against God, those who are against the Bible, and we're interested and we're dead set on our children getting a good education, so we send them to school and we send them to college. Nothing wrong with that. But could they get an education that could destroy their soul? Sure could. What's been profited? If you send them to the best schools of the world and they end up losing their soul, what have you gained? That's a question worth asking. What have we gained? How much better off are we now that we're all educated, but we've lost our faith in God? How much better off are we? What would it profit you? What if you gained this? What if you were successful in business and you doubled your money, then tripled and then quadrupled, and you just became just filthy rich in business? And what a success you are, but you ended up losing your soul in the process because of the compromises you made. What have you gained? What if you kept your family but lost your soul? When there comes a conflict between family and righteousness, you chose the family and you gave up the righteousness, and you didn't follow the principles of the master, but you held on to family because that meant more to you than following the Lord. What if you keep your family intact but you lose your soul? What if you're in an adulterous marriage and you say, I'm not going to lose this marriage. I'm going to keep this person I love, but you lose your soul over that. What have you gained? What if you do something that's fun and you enjoy the fun, but you end up losing your soul? What if in a moment of temptation you give in and it's fun and you enjoy it, but you lose your soul? What have you gained? That's a question worth asking. God asked some good questions, didn't he? That's not all God asked. Those are a few. There were some questions that were asked by men. Let's talk about just a few of those, not as many as we had in the previous category, but here's some questions that were asked by men. Let's turn to Acts, the 9th chapter, if you will. This is the case of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. He saw the Lord on the road to Damascus, and he said, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he said, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. And I want you to notice verse 6. He said, trembling and astonished, he said, Lord, what do you want me to do? Oh, what a good question that is. You ever ask that question? Lord, what do you want me to do? The question is not, what do I want to do? The question is not, what do others expect of me? But Lord, what do you want me to do? You ever ask that question? That's a question worth asking. This time we're asking the Lord, Lord, what do you want me to do? Lord, what do you want me to do in worship? Because that's what I want to do. There may be some things I'd like to do in worship, but that's not what you want me to do. Lord, what do you want me to do? I want to worship like you want me to worship. Lord, what do you want me to do toward others? How do you want me to treat them? Now, I might have an idea of how I want to treat them, but Lord, what do you want me to do? And Lord, how do you want me to be in my family? What kind of husband do you want me to be? What kind of wife do you want me to be? Kind of parent do you want me to be? Lord, what would you have me to do? Are you asking that question? That's a question worth asking. Here's another. Let's back up one chapter, the 8th chapter in verse 30. You remember the Ethiopian treasurer riding along in a chariot reading from Isaiah the prophet. Isaiah 53 was the account where he was reading. And he was asked a question. And Philip joined him at the chariot and he said, do you understand what you're reading? Do you understand what you're reading? That's worth asking, isn't it? If someone saw you reading the scriptures, would you be offended if they asked, do you understand what you're reading? That's what Philip asked him. He's riding along reading in the chariot. Reading from Isaiah the prophet. He didn't understand it because he said, I don't know if the prophet's talking about himself or if he's talking about some other man. There's some difficulties in the prophet. You can well relate to his difficulty. Sometimes it's hard to tell what the prophet's talking about, isn't it? He said, I don't understand it. So he said, do you understand what you're reading? I want to learn from that, that it's not enough just to read the word. We need to know what it means, and we need to understand the scriptures. Do you understand what you're reading? People come sometimes boast of how they have read through the entire scriptures in a year. That's great. Do you understand it? Read 4 chapters today. That's great. Did you understand them? Do you understand what you're reading? That was the question asked in Acts chapter 8, verse 30. It may be that we need someone to guide us, because that's what the eunuch said, wasn't it? How can I accept some men guide me? Do you understand what you're reading? Maybe you need some guidance from someone who's read it before and understands it and has an insight to that scripture. Maybe you need someone to give you the sense, like Ezra the scribe. Ezra the scribe read from the scroll and he gave them the sense. You know what that meant? He explained it to them. He said, here's what the text says and here's what that means. Here's the point of it. Here's what it means in its context. Do you try to understand the text in its context? Do you understand what you're reading? Let's suppose we're reading from Romans chapter 5 in Bible class. Do you just read Romans 5 or do you try to say, I want to know what this text is saying in its context? How it relates to chapters 1 to 4 and how it relates to chapter 6. How does it relate to the theme of the book? What is this passage saying in its context? What is the point of the text? Do you understand what you're reading? Here's another question that was asked. At the Last Supper, when Jesus said in Matthew 26, same account found in Mark chapter 14. Jesus said, one of you will betray me. And each one of the disciples began to say to one another and say to the Lord, Lord, is it I? Now that's a question worth asking. Lord, is it I? They were making personal application. We need to make personal application. Anytime the word is taught, anytime we hear a statement from the Lord, we need to make personal application and ask the question, does that apply to me? We often joke about how lessons are taught, and we always think of application to someone else. The old standard joke is something along the line where people come out who needed the very lesson that was taught. Boy, preacher, you hit them today, didn't you? We're not thinking of application to ourselves. Are you asking the question, Lord, is it I? When someone needs to be telling others the gospel, everyone would agree if we preached a sermon on evangelism, we need to get the gospel out to the world. Someone needs to do that. The question needs to be, is it I? Is that me? Do I need to be the one? When there is some statement made that someone could be drifting and changing and getting weaker and getting more loose, I need to raise the question, Lord, is it I? Could that be me? Lord, is it I? When challenges are given that someone needs to do better than what they've been doing, the question needs to be, Lord, is it I? Could I be the one that needs to do better? When someone needs to say, you know what, I was wrong, I need to correct that. Lord, is it I? Could I be the one that needs to say that? That's a good question. Here's another question. Ananias came to Saul of Tarsus before he was baptized. Saul was praying, you remember? It'd been a while without food. And though he was praying, Ananias came to him and he said, and now why are you waiting? King James says, now why tarriest thou? New King James says, why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. That's a good question, isn't it? That's worth asking. What are you waiting on? Why are you waiting? What are you waiting on? Why are you waiting when you know there is a need in your life? If you're not a Christian, you need to obey the gospel. Why are you waiting when you know there's a need in your life? Why are you waiting when you know what you need to do? I can see you waiting if you say, I don't know what I need to do. I don't know what I'm supposed to do to obey the gospel. I don't know what I'm to do to make correction in my life. But when you know what you need to do and you know there's a need, the question to be asked is, why are you waiting? Why are you waiting? Why are you waiting when there is no promise of a tomorrow? Waiting may mean you'll lose your soul. Why are you waiting when you could have all your sins forgiven? And God forgets it and puts it in the past. And you start a new day with the Lord. Why are you waiting? There may be someone present that needs to obey the gospel. My question to you is, why are you waiting? Here's the third category of questions. God asks questions. He asks good questions. Man asks questions, sometimes of God, sometimes of others. Those are good questions. Here's some questions we might ask ourselves. The question itself may not be found in the text, but the basis for the question would be found. And so let's look at these passages. Let's start with Matthew chapter 10 and verse 37. Jesus issues a challenge here about family. Families are important. God gives us great instructions about family and the importance of family. And yet here's something he said about family. He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Here's a question worth asking based on that text. Do you love God or family more? I'm going to tell you, that's worth asking, isn't it? Do you love God or family more? Well, it's easy to say, I'll tell you what, I love God more. But when push comes to shove, sometimes we love family more. If following God and holding the family comes to a conflict, which one would you choose? You say, I'm trying to do the will of God, and that creates a conflict with the family, and I've got to make a choice. It's either family or God. Those choices were sometimes given. 1 Corinthians 7 implies that. Which one would you choose? I want to tell you, I've had Christians who told me that when it comes between choosing between God and family, I just got to stick with my family. Jesus said, you're not worthy of me. If following God meant you cut off your family, could you do it? It's hard. That's really hard. That's what Jesus is talking about. He's talking about discipleship. That if you're devoted to your family more than you are to me, you're not worthy to be my disciple. Just forget it and leave. I don't want you. I want people who are committed to me over family. That's hard. That's real hard. Can you take a stand against family members? Can you? When they do wrong, a son, a daughter, a mom or a dad or brother or sister, can you do it? You say, I just can't do that. I can't do that. Jesus said, you're not worthy of me. That's hard. That's a question worth asking. Do you love God or family more? Will you always stand with family because they're family? It's my family. I can't turn my back on them. I can't do it. I just can't do it. Go back to our text. Jesus said, he that loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. You're not worthy of me. That's a question worth asking. So look at two passages, one in the old and one in the new, and raise a question about that. And that is 1 Corinthians 7 in verse, or 13 in verse 7. In the descriptions of love, love believes all things, the text says. It's not a gullible spirit. It's the idea of giving the benefit of the doubt. Now keep that in mind as you turn over to the book of Proverbs, the 18th division, and in verse 13, he that answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame. When you draw conclusions before you have all the data, it is foolish. It's a paraphrase of verse 13. Verse 17 says this, he that is first to defend his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. There's two sides to the story. Here's a question worth asking in light of that. Do you give others the benefit of the doubt? That's worth asking. Do you want others to give you the benefit of the doubt? When something looks questionable with you, would you want them to give you the benefit of the doubt or just jump to a conclusion? If something doesn't look good, do you believe the worst or do you believe the best until you have evidence of the worst? If you saw somebody drinking something that it could be some kind of fruit juice or it could be wine at a restaurant, do you just walk away thinking and assuming it's wine or do you give them the benefit of the doubt until you know different? Do you jump to the conclusion you want? And here is someone that's been a thorn in my flesh and I've been looking for something to criticize them and now I've got a chance to jump on that and I'm not giving them the benefit of the doubt. That's a question worth asking. Do you mark people off with shallow evidence? That's a question worth asking. Here's another. Acts chapter 5 and verse 28. The charge that was made to the apostles by the Sanhedrin is that you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine. Here's a question worth asking. Have we filled Shelbyville with the doctrine of Christ? I won't tell you, that's worth asking, isn't it? If it were to be against the law to teach the gospel to others, would there be enough evidence to convict us? What if people were being hauled into court for proselyting and teaching people the gospel of Christ, would there be enough evidence that could be presented? These folks out there at El Bethel are trying to fill the whole city with their doctrine. They don't keep it in the confines of the building. They're going out and trying to teach other people. They're trying to convert them. And here is the evidence where we can convict them and put them in prison. Would there be enough evidence to convict you? That's a question worth asking. If criticism were to be made of this church and the members of this church, would it be that we have filled the city with the doctrine of Christ? I want to say I doubt it. Have we worked hard enough at self-included? I'm indicting myself in that. Are we trying to spread the gospel enough that they would charge us with having filled this whole city with the doctrine of Christ? That's a question worth asking. Let's notice two more questions and the lesson is yours. Here's the first of those two. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers," verse 5. Romans 14 says, "Follow after things which make for peace." Here's the question that's worth asking. Are you a peacemaker? Do you try to get along with others, as per Romans 12? Do you follow the path that makes for peace? Do you analyze your actions, your words, things you say, and you say, you know what, this may create some friction between me and someone else or several people, and I don't want to follow that course. I want to follow this course because this is the more peaceful course. I don't want the path that's going to create friction. I want the path that is peaceful. Do you follow the path of peace? Do you do things that you know will agitate others? Do you try to reach out to your enemy and say, even though they've done me wrong and they've treated me spitefully, I'm going to reach out and try to resolve the difference and be kind to them. I'm going to reach out. They may bite your hand off, but are you going to try to reach out to them? Are you a peacemaker? Let's notice one last question. The lesson will be yours. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 12. Paul told Timothy, "Be thou an example of the believers in word and spirit and faith and purity, etc." Be thou an example of the believers. Told young Timothy that. Here's a question worth asking. What if others followed your example? What would it be like? What if people of this community picked you out above everybody else and said, "Here is the example to follow"? What would they turn out like? What would it be like? Would that person now be considered a diligent disciple? They're just like you, remember. They're following your example. Would they attend all of the time because they're following your example? Would they be respected by others because of their diligence? Could others count on them? You can count on them. They can count on you. We can count on them. What if others followed your example? Those are a few questions worth asking. God asked some great questions. Man asked some good questions. And we need to ask some pondering questions as well of ourselves. Here's another question. Would you become a Christian this morning? If you're not a Christian, would you become one this morning? Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? Would you correct your life this morning if you're an erring child of God? That's a question worth asking too. If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?